help them to assimilate. And this is why he did it, because he knew that the reform movement wouldn't appeal to them. So he thought that a person like Salomon Schechter, who was at the same time, he was accepting of certain changes, and he was scientifically oriented and professional oriented, etc. And at the same time, he was sensitive to religion more than the reform people did, and that's why he actually supported the conservative movement.
And
reform is... the term reform, I mentioned 1825, that's the first time that a congregation or a society adopted that term. But as an organized movement encompassing various congregations, right, as a national movement, it was only united by the 1870s. 1873 is when the Union of American Hebrew Congregations was formed.
You already had reform in Germany starting in the 1780s.
Right, right.
When did it start there?
In Germany. Started? In Germany, it started in the 1830s, 40s. By 1850s, it picked up steam.
But
yeah.
No,
no, there was no organized reform in Germany in the 18th century. It's early 19th century, 1820s, 30s, those years. That's when it started. In the 18th century, you had Mendelssohn. You had ideas, but it was still traditional. It wasn't organized. The practices that we now see were not, you know, each synagogue had different divergent ideas and divergent practices. It wasn't organized and wasn't standardized yet.
There was a form show.
Yeah.
Interacting, that they would have
the Hamburg
school services for the Lutherans, and they would,
yeah,
you know, like trying to be
1808, you say? That's very early. It's possible.
It was, yeah, it was already.
Maybe, that was the earliest one, then. That was the earliest one.
It was already in action by the
I understand,
United
but
States.
You're mentioning the very first, you know, the prototype,
I mean,
you know, the experimental.
An interdenominational show is very much not orthodox already.
As a massive movement that really caught on. Caught on with the population. It didn't start until the 1820s, 30s, and then it took up even more steam in the later decades, in the mid-19th century. Okay.
In 1874, Schiff funded the 92nd Street Y, which is a think tank, a music tank, a cultural tank.
Of the conservatives.
Of the conservatives,
exactly.
Up on 92nd Street.
And another example is the Henry Steep settlement, right? Schiff also funded that. So Schiff funded a lot of efforts, a lot of charity efforts that operated within the immigrant community. And the reason he did it again is because he realized that they were never going to become reformed. He had no illusions about that. The reason he did it is because he felt responsible for them, and also because he wanted to remove the taint, quote unquote, of these new immigrants. Because other Americans were going to say, "Oh, you're Jewish, and they're Jewish." Look how crummy and disgraceful your religion is. So he wanted to basically put up a new facade, make it seem nicer and seem more adaptive and more acceptable. So he wanted those immigrants essentially to assimilate to some extent. If you don't want to be reform, okay, but you know, get rid of your beer, okay, and go to college, and he succeeded. So those organizations like the 92nd Street Y and the Henry Street Settlement and the others were very effective. Okay, Sabata Marais, I'm showing you a picture of him. He was an early proponent of what later became conservative, but he was affiliated with the JTS. He's the founder of the JTS. And he was Italian-born. He was a chazan, a cantor, because many congregations back then, they didn't hire rabbis. They just hired a cantor. The Americans wanted autonomy from the rabbinate. They didn't want to be subservient to the rabbis. And so they hired a chazan who also doubled as the shochet and the mohel and all those other different roles. So he was the modern conservative Judaism ushered in by Schechter probably would not have been acceptable to him. He was more traditional. But he was the founder of JTS, and like somebody mentioned here, the early JTS, or like you mentioned, like the early JTS was more traditional. The early JTS was, to a large extent, they still spoke Yiddish. This was like the first, second generation, and they were very traditional. They were scientific, right? They believed in studying things and professional, and in other manners, in other ways, they adopted American practices. But at the same time, when it came to ritual, they made little changes. Rabbi Jacob Joseph, a very interesting figure. Rabbi Jacob, the Orthodox community was not what was very divided and split. And finally, in 1889, I think that's the year, or the late 1880s, they finally decided in New York City that they wanted the kashrut laws in New York City were abysmal in those years. Nobody kept kashrut properly. And so they decided to hire this Rabbi Jacob Joseph from Vilna, and they gave him the title as Chief Rabbi of New York City, a new title. It didn't exist until then. And the idea was that he would clean house, right? He would organize the kashrut supervision, and he instituted a tax, 1 cent per chicken, to get a stamp, a kashrut seal.
And
this is 1889. This is a specific year, by the way, because a year afterwards he was gone. So what happened is the it's funny, right? So what happened is the shochatim, the butchers, revolted. How dare you? A 1 cent tax on a chicken? We can't afford that. So this is how little regard the people at the time had for kashrut. Essentially, they didn't care about it. They're like, who cares? Like, it's kosher. You don't need to don't tell us. Don't supervise us. We don't need your approval that it's kosher. I tell you it's kosher. And so basically, what seems to have happened is that people didn't realize they had cognitive dissonance, so to speak. They didn't fully appreciate what they were getting themselves into. On the one hand, they wanted a European-trained rabbi, right? They wanted to bolster the laws of kashrut and the observance of kashrut, but at the same time, he didn't do anything radical. It's normal. I mean, it does cost money. The money went to for his salary and for administrative costs. There's no graft in the process. I mean, he didn't do anything wrong, but they were just not psychologically fully prepared for this thing. And the other thing is that many of the petty rabbis in New York City, they felt, oh, this newcomer, I've been here for years, and this guy just came off the boat, and he's chief rabbi, and he gets this nice salary, and it has all the prestige, and he gets all the acclaim, and what do I get? And so they were not fully behind him. Many of the original congregations that actually invited him to come over, they didn't stand behind him when he actually put the program into effect. So a year later, the whole thing disintegrated, and his position evaporated, and eventually, things reverted to the way they were before, which is that each butcher single-handedly certifies that or affirms that my food is kosher. What does that mean? I don't know. Nobody knows what it means. It's kosher. I'm not saying they probably did slaughter it. Probably, I don't know. But did they check the knife before? You know, did they check the lungs of the? I don't. Nobody supervised it. Nobody cared.
It was a feeling.
Yeah, it was a feeling. Exactly, it was a feeling. It felt kosher. There were a lot of signs. They were all over the Lower East Side. There were signs, Busser Kosher. These people were such ignoramuses that sometimes the Busser Kosher was misspelled, and you would see Busser. Right, meat. And some people say that the reason they had to spell it this way is because it wasn't kosher, so they couldn't do false advertisement. Somebody put out Busser, so they wouldn't make a claim that's not true. But at the same time, it felt kosher because it was Hebrew characters. So, yeah, it was good enough, yeah.
Maybe one of the problems was they stopped taxing the wrong people. Because to be a shulchan is a very hard job.
It raised the price. It meant a lot of money.
That might have meant a concern about poverty and about making a living and a lot of other things. And like today, sometimes we're charging the wrong people. Maybe the community should be paying instead of penalizing the shochet for doing one of the harder jobs.
The shochet at the time were married. The shochet about the slaughter, the butchers were the ones who basically. They were the proximate cause for his downfall. They were the ones who revolted against him. And why? Yes, I understand why. At the time, the primary objective of American Jews was integration. Okay, they wanted to succeed in America. And anything that related to halacha, to observance, to tradition, to identity, took second place, played second fiddle. And this interfered because money was a very critical commodity back then. These were immigrants, second generation. You know, a cent meant a lot of money for them, and it was so obvious. See, that's the other thing. See, nowadays a lot of products are marketed through in through ingenious ways that the consumer doesn't is not aware that they're paying for it, right? But if somebody is aware that I'm paying a cent more per chicken because it's certified kosher by RJJ, no, I don't want to do that. You know, I can buy chicken from another slaughterer who also says it's kosher. It just says kosher, and he doesn't charge me the additional cent, right? Oh, that's how he deludes himself. It's just as kosher. It's not just as kosher. But he thinks that it's just as kosher because the butcher is advertising that it's just as kosher. It's the same problems that we have nowadays with our market economics. You know, we have people advertising things that they are in a certain way, and they attract consumers to buy them, but they're inferior from the true product, from the brand name. Okay, some other... Of course, but it's a huge... But in terms of reliability, in terms of reliability, having an
RJJ...
That was the point here. That wasn't the reason. The reason was because it was so obvious that everyone was paying a cent more. It was too stark. It was too. Yeah, I don't think. I think the money was the biggest issue, and the fact that the slaughterers had to charge more, and they felt that they were being put at a disadvantage because the consumer would go to a different shochet, or the consumer would stop keeping kosher altogether. Yeah, you know, for them. They had to be in business. That was very important. And if they thought that they were going to lose business because of this, then that was a reason for them to object. Okay, the Ramaz, Moses Zevulun Margulis. Has anyone heard of him? The Ramaz was, of course, you have the Ramaz Day School nowadays, and which is named after him. So he was an early exponent of orthodoxy. So orthodoxy, what does orthodoxy mean? The early orthodoxy, how did it differ from conservative Judaism? Well, it differed in theory. And to a large extent, a different theory, which means that it did not accept the validity, for example, divine revelation. Okay, it insisted on divine revelation, insisted at Torah Shebal Peh, like the oral law, was passed on, was transmitted, right, by through Moses on Sinai. So a lot of the theoretical underpinnings of Judaism, which under conservative Judaism is okay, it's okay to question, it's acceptable, as long as you keep, right? As long as you still don the prayer shawl and the tefillin and you observe Shabbat. You can go to university, you can question, you can engage in the scientific process. But for the Orthodox, that was much more frowned upon. And so he was a proponent of orthodoxy. And so here you have a picture of the Ramaz. And it's interesting that in the left photo you see his kashketel. So he was a first generation immigrant. He still spoke Yiddish. And the Ramaz is affiliated with KJ. I'm sure many of you have heard KJ, Kahal. What is it called? Kihilaf Jeshurun, right? On the upper...
Kiryas Joel.
Upper East Side, thank you. Right, right. He was born in Europe somewhere. And he came, and it's very interesting because his grandson was Joseph Lookstein. And he took over, after he passed away, he took over his pulpit. And he became much more modernized. So look at this next photo, Joseph Lookstein. He's also affiliated with KJ and with centrist orthodoxy. I wouldn't even call it modern orthodoxy. Modern orthodoxy is a term that, it's a post-World War II term. So I would call the pre-World War II orthodoxy of the upper, what did you say, upper east side or west side? Upper east side. Okay, so that kind of, that milieu, you know, maybe you can call it modern orthodoxy, centrist, whatever you want to call it, orthodoxy, or simply plain orthodoxy. And so that differs very much from other streams of orthodoxy, especially the Haredi version and others. End of slide. Okay, so let me open the floor. Did I cover everything? More or less. Okay, let me open the floor for questioning because I've talked too much already. Okay, questions, official questions now. Yes.
I can't figure him out. Rabbi Eshel, I read his books. Yeah, he seems very dynamic. You have anything on him?
I don't have anything. The one thing I know about Aaron Joshua Heschel is that he participated in the civil rights movement. He marched hand in hand with other black leaders. And so, yeah, he was, you know, obviously he was a conservative.
And a little controversial, because he was taught in JTS, you know that. But he was, but to my knowledge, he was orthodox. His writings are strictly orthodox, and he believed in Turner B'Shamayim. But yet, I heard he didn't, I don't think he found a home there. They never gave him 10-year.
Maybe that's why.
I think he kept halacha. He was from what I gather, but strictly orthodox.
It's possible that the reason he didn't get tenure of that is because his views were a little too traditional. It's possible.
One interesting thing is that the conservative movement was very sympathetic with the civil rights movement
and the reform too. Reform and the conservative, too. Both of them.
But and that actually a lot of the funding that came to support the civil rights movement came from the conservative and the Jewish community. They were the ones really funding.
Right. The statistics say that 50% of the white people who marched south and participated in all those activities to try to integrate the South were Jewish. That's a huge number. 50%.
And why?
And many of them got arrested. Many of them got arrested in the South.
But the question...
Two of the three that died in 1963 were Jewish boys.
Yeah.
But the question is why?
Why? Because for several reasons. For one, the Jews just came... This was just after the Holocaust, right? So they felt...
This is the 60s.
Right, so yeah. So it was 10, 20 years after the Holocaust. And they felt on an experiential level, they felt sympathetic to them because the same persecution that they're undergoing, that's what we've been undergoing all our, you know, all our history. And it culminated with the Holocaust. So, you know, it was natural, it was organic for them to sympathize and embrace their cause. But secondly, the other reason why reform and conservative movements embrace that is because they strongly believe, as opposed to orthodoxy, which placed primary emphasis on practice, for the reform and the conservative, the ideals and the ethical precepts of Judaism are also extremely important. And for them, this empathy, right, with the cause of the poor and the downtrodden and the oppressed. Okay, so all of those ideas were very central in their theology. Not just keeping the actual ritual, the law. All right, so for them, and so yes, you mentioned conservative, true, but also the reform were also extremely active. Okay, so the reform, again, the reform strongly believed in prophetic Judaism, ethical monotheism. It strongly believed in distilling the Torah, our tradition, into its ethics. Right, what does God really want from us? It's not about the legalistic aspects. It's about the let's see broadly what the bigger picture is. It's reformed, yes.
So what's interesting is to what degree we'll find elements of, I don't know, Hasidus or like also some like Kabbalistic ideas that become kind of ingrained in kind of interesting ways within more liberal movements. So, for instance, you have ideas around Tikkun and so on that become Tikkun Olam in a very kind of social justice-oriented way within conservative Judaism and other movements. You have ideas around ongoing, like the idea of revelation as not being something which is static, but which is ongoing, and that you can talk about also within a kind of Kabbalistic dialectic that also has reverberations within conservative Judaism and other liberal movements as well, which actually serves the basis or creates the basis for a more dynamic form of halacha. Because if revelation is ongoing, then arguably so too is the halachic process. And that connection is made out of other religion as well. So it's interesting that what we perceive as being, some people might argue that the complete bastardization of these ideas, but you could argue that they're also intimately connected in a certain development in such a way, if not for these earlier antecedents, found in what we would perceive as more traditional.
Okay, to summarize what you just said, you're saying that there were certain Kabbalistic influences on conservative and reform Judaism. Okay, my remark on that would be that Tikkun Olam is a Hebrew terminology for a concept that existed way before. I mean, it's completely independent from any Kabbalistic influence, because the idea of Tikkun Olam in English would simply be social justice, right? And so social justice is something that the early reformists saw, like I explained earlier, as the essence of what Judaism is all about. Because they saw, the early Reformed Jews, they saw Orthodox Judaism as corrupt, as a corrupted form of Judaism. Because they opened the Bible and started reading Isaiah and all the other prophets. And they saw, oh, this is what they want, you know? What does the prophet say in the name of God? I don't ask you to sacrifice, what do I ask you? Not to sacrifice more animals. I ask you, quote me, what does it say? Lama Rav Zuch Chacham, right. It's a very famous verse in Isaiah, which basically summarizes, epitomizes this whole idea, which is that God says, I don't want your sacrifices. I want a pure...
That's not what he says. He doesn't want corrupt people bringing sacrifices.
I'm literally translating the verse. The verse actually does say that. And literally, the literal translation says, I do not want your sacrifices. I do want a pure heart and being kind to one another. That's what the prophet says. So to them, see, the reformists put emphasis on prophetic Judaism, on the prophets, at the expense of the Pentateuch. In other words, the purity laws of Leviticus were not that important, but the prophetic ideals of what Judaism stands for, those that put emphasis on that. So for them, social justice is very important, because that's the essence of Judaism. It's not the legalism. It's not the ritual. It's not the purity laws, the priestly laws. It's about justice. It's about being kind, being honest, okay, helping one another. It's all about social matters.
And so,
right, right. So yeah.
So can you move closer, please? Can you move closer so we can record this?
Okay. So my question though is, okay, just as there are arguments that, you know, Shalom, somebody like Gershom Shalom would make, that Sabbateanism was not such a radical break from an already pre-existing structure that allowed it to be created. My question... Wait. So what I'm saying is, in other words, is there an appropriation, though, of the same language? When we say Tikkun Olam within conservative or liberal movements in Judaism, isn't it appropriating the same language when we talk about, people talk about in Hasidus, about the idea of, you know, doing a tikkun? Like, to me, that seems to be, maybe it's subversive for some people, but it's still appropriating the same language, it seems.
Maybe they use the same language, but the idea wasn't inspired by them. The idea, the modern reformists, when they talk about Tikkun Olam, they did not borrow the idea from the Hasidim or from Kabbalists. They may have borrowed the term, okay, because again, modern reformists do like to use Hebrew terminology, right? As opposed to the classical reformists, which discarded everything Hebrew. And so for them, yes, they would naturally refer to it with a Hebrew term. So how do you say social justice in Hebrew? So they used Tikkun Olam. So maybe they borrowed the actual term they may have borrowed from Kabbalistic circles, but the idea is completely, completely independent. In fact,
and what does Tikkun Olam mean?
It means the correction, the improvement of the world, improvement of society. Olam is better translated as society.
I think that's one historiography, and I'm not so sure. Like, could you substantiate it one way or the other? I don't know. That's what I'm questioning.
I know the history of reform, and reform was, you know, reform scorned Kabbalism. In fact, there was one reformist that said.
There was one reformist who called
Kabbalism as the garbage of literature, something like that.
What I'm questioning is it a subversive reappropriation of that term? But why not, though? I'm saying, why isn't that a possibility?
It's a possibility, but it's not like that historically. If you're asking how did the bat get wings, right? It's not the same as the mammalian evolution of the bat. In other words, I'm sorry, the bird, right? The bat is a mammal, so the bat's wings is completely independently evolved from a fly's wings, for example, right? it looks the same. It serves a similar function, but it's completely independent. It's not related. Okay, different birds evolved birds from the same source, but not so the same a fly and a bird. Okay, a fly also has wings, but it happened at a separate epoch, separately inspired, separate natural exigencies for it, etc. So that would be my answer. Like, historically, they're not affiliated. So yes, are there Tikkun Olam ideas in Kabbalism? Yes, of course there are. But it's a completely different vantage point. I mean, their starting point and their process of reasoning and their conclusions, everything is different.
How come what?
I don't know historically whether or not. I don't know. It's something that I think needs to be researched more. I think it's something that needs to be researched more. This is something that was always presented to me this way as well, but I don't I don't know. I haven't done enough research to be able to argue whether
I've never heard the word until recently.
Right. I think it's too coincidental.
Right. Maybe so.
I agree. So speaking of Isaac, if there's enough demand, we'll do another one.
One thing about the conservative movement, having been brought up in that, is that they really go on intuition a lot more than they go on laws, and yet they had their own interpretation of what was work. And so it's a convenience. So if you need to drive on Shabbos, you drive on Shabbos.
Exactly.
Because you have the suburbs in the 50s.
No, even here in the 50s in New York. I mean, this was my family's early synagogue.
That was originally when Jews started moving out to the suburbs.
Well, then they began to
where the synagogue was the central point of their life. Okay, that they gave that dispensation. Okay, this I worked with a conservative rabbi for numerous years. Okay, and he said the only ones that ended up driving were the rabbis themselves, because the people that drove anyhow. Okay, all right. Let's
be honest. They don't even close to the table.
The origin of that issue is about 7 years. If you had trouble making a living, you could be free again. So the land itself, you're right, because you failed to get your actual.
No, one was Shemitah.
But you wouldn't be a slave or a wage slave either for more than 7 years.
Yeah.
And in America, you can be a wage slave for all your life, and you can be squeezed out of real estate unless you're tripling up on your own. It's a very brave but difficult struggle that Reina and other Orthodox people had done to be able to keep move up without, neither driving nor having a larger number of people to keep that. But people forget it's not really assimilation, it has to do with another.
I don't buy the whole.
I don't think people